Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Author Kevin Barry, good morning.
Good morning to you, Mr. O'Connor. How are you?
And you have a terrific new novel out, The Heart of Winter, but we'll talk about it commingled with five songs you've picked as well that connect you to different parts of your life. So you grew up in Limerick City. What kind of music was in the house?
In the house, growing up, older sisters and an older brother, so Radio Luxembourg was actually on every night. I'm that old now, Brendan, you know, so I would remember kind of everything in the charts from kind of early ABBA days, 73, 74 up, and a big disco revolution going on in Limerick City at that time.
That changed your life.
With the Jackson 5 and all of that stuff as well. So yeah, I've a fairly terrifyingly encyclopedic knowledge of pop music from about mid-70s to late 80s, you know, and then it all disappears.
Yeah. My mother used to always, she'd come in, we'd be watching Top of the Pops, and she says, is that coming up in the exam? But ultimately, I feel we've made use of all that wasted time, haven't we?
It's funny when you think back to your kind of teenage days now, and for me, that's kind of early to mid-80s and up, you know. It was so tribal, it was so kind of feudal. You know, there were so many different little gangs around town, you know, the mods and the goths and the new romantics. And I was trying my hand at all of them at one stage or other, you know. And it was unfortunate for me in lots of ways because a ginger-haired goth is an awful course to try and pull off, you know. No matter how much studio line hairspray and backcombing you do, you still don't look like Echo and the Bunnymen at the far end of it, you know.
Yeah. So your first choice is from New Order. Why this?
I was thinking of walking around Limerick City, very different looking place than it is now, I would have to say. Maybe when I'm 16 or 17, so 85 or 86, and I have the big Sony Walkman headphones on with the orange foamy bits, you know, and I was thinking, what was I listening to? And the first thing that came to mind was probably New Order, something like that. And I had a gang. There was five or six of us all went to the Christian Brothers on Sexton Street and we'd hang out together. But I definitely had the kind of moody, loner, tortured poet department kind of gatch about me as well at that age, I'd say.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah.
So it was...
Was there output at that stage?
Was there was, yeah? Actually, yeah. Okay. I used to go to the graveyard at St. Mary's Cathedral in town and write poems, lying among the headstones, you know. They were desperate. They'd be all about girls and debt. But they weren't working out very well at
both
all.
Both as far away as each other at that stage of your life. Exactly.
And the problem was, I think I was too happy as well for the poetry stuff, you know. I wasn't a melancholy enough young fella. But I had the notion definitely from kind of good English teachers that all writers have in common, telling you that you were able to kind of write off the cuff. I remember I had a great English teacher, Mr. Lynch, in secondary school. He's always said to me, oh, Barry, you write off the cuff. You know, that it was kind of natural to me. Yeah, that gives you great kind of notions about yourself then, really, and sort of kind of became a thing that as soon as I left school, I was starting to think in terms of writing for the papers or something, you know.
Okay, and we'll come to that, but let's have a listen to your first music choice. First, here's New Order and Ceremony. Order and Ceremony, and that's author Kevin Barry's first music choice today. And by the way, if you're thinking, would they not have started with a poppy one? That's the poppy one.
That's as poppy as it's getting, yeah.
So you were saying then you started thinking of writing for the paper. So you kind of became an old-fashioned kind of hard-boiled reporter, didn't you?
I remember I started at what was then NIHE Limerick. I started a degree out there, European Studies. So I was all set for diplomatic status in Brussels, I'd say. But literally a few weeks in, there was a new local paper starting up in Limerick. And I knew the guy who was going to be involved in it. And he said, do you want a job? As a junior reporter, as a cub reporter, you know. a job in Limerick in the late 80s was news in itself. Like, so I kind of, I remember going to the college advisor out in NIHE, South African guy, and he said, run, you know, go for it. Go, are they actually giving you a wage? And I did. I had what's a very old fashioned now is that proper cub reporter training. I was sent to the local secretarial college for the shorthand and touch type, and neither of which I ever managed. But did the courthouse in Limerick for a couple of years. The council meetings were brilliant as well. I always remember this great ongoing feud between the late Jim Kemmy, who was the Democratic Left, was his party in Limerick, and Willie O'Dea, the Fianna Fáil TD. They'd be having such a barney with each other every year. And of course, they were the best of pals on the quiet, but it would just be... And the local paper, they'd ring me each week and give me quotes about, right. Do you hear Kev, do you hear what that other fella's saying there now below at the council? I vividly remember the day Jim Kemmy stood up and said, this city has to change. We have a lovely river, you know, out there. What we need now is we have to put cafes all the way down there, and we can be serving cappuccinos. And there was other councillors standing up going, are we going to be in our overcoats drinking the cappuccinos down there now? Because you'll be frozen off that river, you know. The city really started to change around the early 90s. There was a great city manager in Limerick. It was a Cork man called Jack Higgins, and he was fantastic. And he decided... That's a beautiful river. And the city had always been built away from it. Back in the day, they was thinking, you get TB off that river. stuff. So it really changed the orientation of the city, and it really improved. And it's, I must say, it's a very different place when you go back now.
But at the time, you were gravitating away from it, yeah. Really, kind of gravitating towards Cork. Did London come first?
There was definitely the summers in London kind of a thing.
You were there for the birth of Acid House, were you?
I was. Yeah. I went over. I remember myself and two pals went over for the summer. And we went over in ripped jeans and suede jackets with Leonard Cohen tapes.
Yeah.
About the third night there, we saw this Acid House night at the Camden Palace. And inside 3 days, we were in Dayglo orange jeans. The whole look had entirely changed, and the whole music preference had changed. And that was the year I got a start on the sites, on the building sites. I think I lasted an hour and a half on the building site. I remember the foreman, big kind of Tipperary man, took one look at me with a wheelbarrow, and he called me over and very kind said, listen, he said, I'll pay you for the morning. All right. move on from manual labour if you have any sense. And then having discovered the Acid House, discovering that we were able to run minibuses down to a certain place called Sir Henry's Nightclub in Cork, which had the sweat dance of a Thursday and Saturday. And that's how I started going down to Cork. When I thought I was going to kind of start freelancing, Cork seemed just a bit bigger.
And was there more going on as well in Cork for you in terms of
it was
creativity, growing, all that?
Like, it had what Cork at that time had. It had a kind of a confidence in itself, kind of culturally, I think, that Limerick didn't have at the time. Limerick was kind of trapped in between Galway, which had its arts festival and all that kind of stuff, and Druid Theatre and all that. Cork always had the jazz and also just a bit bigger. And both, I would say, were quite self-confident in cultural terms. And Limerick had a kind of an inferiority complex a little bit, which was nicely got rid of, I think, in subsequent 30 years. But Cork, there was definitely more going on. Like, I was thinking about it, it was a great place in some ways to be trying to start off any kind of creative life for very pragmatic reasons. You could have quite a decent flat in Cork for 50 quid a week or whatever it was at the time. It mightn't have heating on it, you know what I mean? You might be going in with the bales of briquettes and the meter in the hall, but you could get by without breaking your back doing loads of little jobs.
Yeah.
Even as a freelance journalist, I was able to kind of pay the rent and get by, and had plenty of time to be starting to attempt to write short stories or whatever it was at the time.
And the song you've picked from that time kind of is not a dance song at all. The opposite, really. Tindersticks, Travelling Light. Why this?
Yeah. Again, when I was kind of coming up with the list, I was just going, go with your gut first pick now. If you think about 1990s in Cork, what are you hearing? And I hear that song, you know, and it would have been a Walkman effort. And it's probably on what we used to refer to as the Walk of Shame in Cork, which is a different Walk of Shame than the usual one. The Walk of Shame in Cork in the early mid-90s was out to the Western Road, Esso, at 5 in the morning to buy Rizlas, you know? And if you listened to this on the way out, and I always vividly remember the They had a huge, gigantic inflatable tiger tied up to the Esso station on the Western Road. And there was always lads having the very original idea, we'll set the tiger loose now and climb it up. And I think a few tigers were let loose over Cork City in those days. But it's, tender sticks definitely send me to that decade and that city, I think, whenever I hear it.
Okay, here's Kevin Barry's second choice, Tinder Sticks, Travelling Light.
Well, comes with the hurt and the guilt and the memory. If I had to take that with me, I'd never get from my bed.
There's a crack in the road where the rain pours through. That's the place you always decide to sit.
Yeah, I know I'm there for hours. The water running down my face.
Do you really think you keep it all that well here?
No, but I travel like.
Tinder Sticks there, Travelling Light. That's Kevin Barry's second choice today. Of course, the National took that ball and ran with it to great success, didn't they, basically?
Yeah, when you listen to it now, they did, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. And of course, we encountered each other back then.
We did, yeah.
Now, my memories of that time are patchy, to say the best. Yeah. But one thing I do remember about you, so I was kind of running a local kind of rag or whatever
the what's
you want
on
to call
the what's
it.
On
yeah,
Mike, yeah,
yeah. And you were, we like, it was very, very placed with notions. We had a were you the club correspondent or the
night? I was, yeah. So listeners unfamiliar with Cork listings magazines of the early 90s wouldn't remember the Raz. I think there was a little office on Half Moon Street. That's my
favourite.
There
was a little office across from over a pub across from the opera house there. Yeah, that's right.
And so for some reason, Brendan O'Connor was made editor of it. And I was the nightclub correspondent, which was a very suitable position for me.
There's a sitcom there straight away. Yeah.
A very suitable position for me at the time, because I used to get up out of bed about 6:30 in the day, you know. But I used to be writing about the club nights and the records and whatnot that was going on around the place.
But you know, the funny thing about it was that I do remember you were a writer because you always wrote a piece. You always gave a piece of writing. You didn't just write a kind of a roundup of what's on. There was always writing in it.
Yeah, and I think I always sensed, and I often would be in a kind of a cranky way, but I would always sense that I was able to get my own personality out and whatever it was typing up. Even if I was like slagging off to Frank and Walter's gig up at Nancy Spades or whatever it was, my personality would definitely start to come out on the typewriter as it was at the time. So slowly but surely I was thinking kind of, yeah, maybe you should try and write books, you know.
So you disappeared to a caravan then?
Yeah. I got a plan together. So this was actually, significantly enough, I was 29 and I had one of those classic 29-year-old good hard chats with myself, you know. I said, are you serious about this now? Are you seriously going to try and write a book? So I said, I'll write a rake of features for the Examiner and the Times and whoever else I was doing stuff for, and I'll save up enough for 3 months. And I sublet the flat in Cork and I bought a little Father Ted caravan and put it down on the beach in Alahees, Berra Peninsula, Farran. Lovely spot, you know. I didn't even have a laptop, I'd say, at the time. So I was down there with my notebooks at the start of the summer.
Yeah.
And kind of cracking the knuckles, you know, going, right, young man, let's write that novel. And I had nothing. I had absolutely nothing. You know, like the bits of short stories and fiction I would have been writing up to then were very typical 20-something-year-old man kind of stuff. Stories about clubs and drugs and nightclubs and kind of vaguely Irvine Welsh type material, and nothing wrong with him. But, you know, when it's a copy, it's not so hot. But not getting anywhere then and trying to figure out what in the name of hell am I going to write a novel about.
And you found the copper mines.
I was going on these long, sort of increasingly agitated and desperate walks up around the hills outside Alahees, kept passing the old abandoned copper mines. And then back in the Boole Library, I went up to the Boole Library in UCC back in town and started researching it. Discovering the mines played out in the 1880s and all the miners went to Butte, Montana. And by the start of the 1890s, there was about 10,000 of a County Cork population in this little city up in the Rocky Mountains. And I remember saying to myself, it's a Western with Cork accents. I'm away in a hack.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
How could I not try and write this? Made my first trip to the US that year in October 99. And the first thing that struck me was like, it's still an incredibly, or at that time it was, and I'm sure it still is, very proud of its Irish heritage. I opened the phone books when I checked into a little motel there and it was just page after page of Harringtons and O'Sullivans. It was all West Cork names.
Right.
And you could see those big boiled ham West Cork heads walking around the streets with cowboy hats on them, you know? And I got great stuff. I was telling everyone, I'm writing a novel now about this place. What have you got for me, you know? And they were incredibly kind. Fed me and brought me out drinking and introduced me to this historical society in that place. I remember in the library, they were giving me letters that Cork copper miners had sent back to their mothers in 1893. I had incredible stuff. I had all the texture I needed for a novel. And I went back to Cork. I wrote like 120,000 words. And I knew even as it was going down that this is going nowhere. I had no characters. So eventually it was kind of pushed to one side. And I started to write kind of short stories. And they were funny and they were starting to sound a bit like me. The novel thing hadn't been sounding like me at all. I have it at home in County Sligo, that 120,000 words. It's in a box under one of the beds.
That'll be for your papers for
hopefully, yeah. But I was afraid to look at it, you know. I do remember when Deadwood, the great TV show, started about 2005 or 6, watching that, loving it and saying to myself, That's how you could have done your beautiful
novel. There's Deadwood vibes off the Heart and Winter for sure, yeah.
But it was just kind of, it's weird then, it just, you know, I wrote and published 6 other books and we got to the kind of second long year of the pandemic when we were all ready to turn in and face the wall. And I knew I had to start a novel and I said, what about if I try it now? Is my Western there for me now? And I had the idea for 2 runaway lovers in mind because that's always a great setup. Badlands and, you know, thinking of movies as much as anything and True Romance and Wild at Heart and all that kind of stuff. And I was thinking, yeah, maybe now is the time. And I had a ball with it, I must say, but I finally did come to write it in 2021 to 22.
And we'll come back to it actually because I'm conscious we need to punctuate this conversation with some music.
Sure.
So Nina Simone, Baltimore. You're repositioning this as Baltimore, basically. Well, a West Cork song.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of the great West Cork songs. Apparently what happened, she only went once to West Cork. She went to Skull.
Right.
I wasn't gone in it. And then she went out to Baltimore for a few days, loved it, and got the song straight away, you know. Always puts West Cork in my mind anyway.
Okay, here we go. Kevin Barry's third choice, Nina Simone, Baltimore. That's Nina Simone in Baltimore. That's Kevin Barry's third choice today. So it's interesting that you went to Butte, even as a young writer. Your first instinct was, I need to go to the place. And you still walk the land a lot. Place is important. You write on location a lot of the time, don't you?
Yeah. I do. It's what passes for research for me more than anything is to go to the place and to kind of soak it up a little bit, you know. And I remember when I was writing my last novel, Nightboat to Tangier, about the 2 former Corkonian hashish smugglers, Morris and Charlie, waiting down in the Algeciras ferry terminal. I actually went to that ferry terminal on the way over to Morocco and sat around in the cafe writing this lots of this Cork dialogue, you know, and I'd be kind of looking up waiting to see the lads. Yeah. It gets a bit nutty sometimes, you know, it gets a bit crazy. When I was doing my John Lennon book,
yeah,
he used to go primal scream therapy and he bought an island and in Clue Bay to do it, and I went out there and I started roaring out me, like I started doing a bit of primal scream. I felt I should.
Yeah.
You see,
yeah.
And work great. I've been right as rain since, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You let it all go, did you? And you and your wife Olivia, you've lived around a lot as well and travelled a lot, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah. We were like started going out, live in Cork back in the year 2000, but we were in the UK for about 6 or 7 years. And I've travelled around a lot, I guess, over the years as well. In a kind of unadventurous way, I always go to Spain and the United States. I love visiting those two countries and in detail and going around them a bit, you know. We're based in County Sligo now, in South Sligo, since 2007. But
how did you end up there?
It was like we just came back and Liv had got a job in DCU and was teaching law out in DCU. And like we were trying to buy a house to put all the boxes of books in. Basically, because there was about 85 boxes of books at that stage, and someone said to me, Leitrim is cheap. Try Leitrim. So we went up, and neither of us had ever really been to the Northwest, and we saw one place in Leitrim, and like, no, thought no. And then saw an ad for this place, an old RIC barracks in Loch Arrow there outside Ballinafad. And just one of those weird ones, you know, went to see it, walked in the door and said, yeah, that's it. That's the one, that'll do. Very few distractions from the writing desk, you know. There's no excuse not to be going and doing your work. But it's nice. It is the kind of 300-odd days of showers you get a year in the Northwest, all right. I always thought, like, you having been born in Limerick and spent most of a decade in Cork, you'll never find wetter than one of those cities, you know. And I found it by God. it's like, oh. So, yeah, I travel as much as I can in the kind of darker months, really.
And the next song does bring us to the writing shed where the magic happens. So now, if people thought that we were going a bit John Kelly already, we're now going to be, this is now middle of the night on RT2 music. Lee Scratch Perry and the Upsetters, Dub Revolution.
Made one of the great artistic gestures of the 20th century, actually. He burned down his own studio in Jamaica, the Black Ark Studio, because he believed it to be possessed by evil spirits. He'd brought in witch doctors first to try and get rid of him, but no joy, you know?
Yeah.
You should nearly try it out here, like, you know, see what...
Yeah, you see, I would worry about you down in the stone shed listening to this all day. So you'd get up then and I would definitely skank,
for a good 14, 15 minutes of an afternoon, yeah. I'd do
okay,
a bit of
and to change the position of the body a bit and something might come then.
Loosen it up, game of 5-1 and back at the pros then, you know.
Okay, I suppose you have to make your own entertainment if you're stuck in a stone
when
shed,
you live far out, yeah.
So then The Heart of Winter reappeared to you in the pandemic. Yeah. You're sitting there, we've heard the soundtrack and we've a picture of you now in the shed.
Yeah. And I thought, now could be the moment, you know. And what I didn't realise, what I didn't have the kind of ability to do in 1999 when I attempted it first, was how to cut away at it, you know. But I realised this could just be about these two lovers, this young couple who have to go on the run from the place and you're off, and just focus in on them. Tom, an Irishman, and Polly, an American woman. And I said, I'll give them a week each. I'll try him for a week and I'll try her for a week. And I started writing this dodgy Irish poet lad, an absolute degenerate junk fella, in Butte, Montana in the 1890s for about a week. And it was kind of like he was on this kind of bar crawl and brothel crawl around the town. I thought, this feels promising. I'm getting some of the world building into it naturally. Then the second week, Monday morning, I said, I'll go in and try this American girl he's about to take up with. And I started writing Polly, and in about 10 minutes I said, I have a novel. I just knew straight away.
Yeah.
Well, her voice was kind of there for me. And like, there's...
You do it out loud, do you?
I do a lot of it out loud, yeah. Once I've got a first draft down and I'm doing a kind of a second draft, I act it out. I do all the voices, and I kind of... I like to hear it on the air because you can feel where you're evading the story. It's a great tool for a fiction writer of the year, you know. And you also hear a kind of... I think it kind of can sound a bit precious when you start talking about prose, you know. But I do believe every fictional story has a kind of an internal kind of a rhythm to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tune. And you get it often in a couple of sentences. You know, you just suddenly hear and you go, that's it. That's the whole book. I have to say, it's great fun to write a Western, you know.
Yeah.
I mean...
Are you putting on... Sorry, I'm stuck back there. Are you putting on voices? You're in the room on your own, yeah, now. You've had a, you've maybe danced around for 50 minutes. Are you putting on voices?
I'm doing women's voices? I'm doing all the accents as well. And there's like Cornish and Yorkshiremen and American outlaws and all sorts.
Excellent.
In this. So it's... I've always said it, you know, the writing of fiction has a lot in common with the motions of madness, you know. There's a lot of other hearing voices and trying to tune into them.
Yeah.
And trying to make something of them. But I'm trying to make it as intense an experience for the reader as I possibly can, where they're really transported to this kind of world for a while, where they're in Butte, Montana, or they're stealing a horse and lighting out for the Badlands, you know.
Yeah, and it is very much that, actually. And it is... I wouldn't be now the biggest fan of historical fiction, right? And neither would I be the biggest fan of kind of lyrical, almost poetic kind of writing. Yeah. But actually, this is just wonderful. Like, it does pick you up and carry you along like a poem or a song or something. And there's a particular whole kind of aesthetic to it, isn't there, that you've gone into, like...
There is, and listeners, I can even see a tear crawling down his jaw now as we speak. But yeah, I must say, it's been a very nice early response from people reading it. I think the kind of, as the young people say, the feels come through with it, you know. They feel, it feels like a proper doomed romance, I think.
And a bit of magic and kind of...
There's all that.
Ghostiness and stuff as well.
All of that is coming
into it. You're getting into that down in Sligo as well.
Big time.
Yeah.
Big time into that now as well, you know. My God, we had some visit from the Aurora a few weeks ago. It was a spectacular up where we were. And you could easily be convinced, there was stuff going on. But it was, Tom considers himself to be a kind of a witch and is tuned into all sorts of occult phenomena as well. And I think... Irish people are never 100% rational, you know. No matter how much we try and dress it up, we always kind of drift into these areas too, given half a chance, I think.
Okay, the final piece of music, and you're really going to take the biscuit here now, but it's kind of relates to the book and the vibe and the time and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting to read. My background reading about this was a lot about Irish migration to the United States in the kind of the late 1800s, you know, and the way they organized themselves, the communities, you know.
Yeah.
And like, we were always great immigrants. They're very personable people, but also there was a canniness behind it, you know. So when the 10,000 Corkonians got to Butte, like, the first thing they did was they opened about 30 pubs, right? the place. And from there, very quickly, they took over the police, and it took over the political apparatus of the town. It was a great little Irish world in microcosm to kind of study and to get into. And I was trying to think then about the Irish community over there. What would they have been listening to? And our last man today is probably a little bit early, but he has the right vibe for it, I think. He was huge in Irish America in the kind of early decades of the 20th century. We're going to go to the Count. We're going to go to Count John McCormack.
Just before we do that... Was it the end of the Old West at this stage? Is the Wild West as we know it was just kind of finishing off? Or was that when the Irish came in and started?
Yeah, and it's a really interesting time, actually. The reason they were out there taking copper out of the hills was because electrification was starting. You know, they were electrifying America. So it was the mix that electrified America, essentially. Like, one of Tom's many sort of little half employed day jobs here and there is in the photographic studio. And it was the first time a photo studio was opening on every main street. And for the first time, very ordinary, very working class men and women were thinking about their image And they were thinking about how they were presenting themselves. And they were sending photos back home to West Cork. Oh, your man's getting on fabulous out in Bute, you know. And it was like the Toffs had been at that for centuries, getting themselves painted. But this was the first time that the real ordinary working man and working woman was thinking, geez, I can have a go at this whole kind of getting glammed up business, you know. So it's an interesting time.
Women wanted to be racy, they'd look back over the shoulder.
That was the style in the 1890s, the over-the-shoulder number, you know.
Okay, Kevin Barry's new book is The Heart in Winter. It's published by Canongate, and I think it's officially out on Thursday, but I think it's around in the bookshops.
Should be
already,
around as we speak, I'd say, Brendan. Yeah.
Okay, Kevin Barry, thank you very much. And we'd play out on your final music choice. This is the Count John McCormack, or John Count McCormack sometimes too, it seems.
I just think of him as the Count.
The Count. Believe me, if all those endearing young charms.